So I wanted to share a little bit about what we've been doing in Kruger National Park. And I think John already stole my thunder in terms of summarizing this, is looking at what might be one soil's loss is another soil's gain. So just keep that in mind as we go through this. This work that we're doing in Kruger National Park, if you drive through this park today, what you'll see are these repeating patterns of soil colors, primarily as you drive from crests down to hill slopes, downhill slopes until you reach sort of the toe slope position. And it was these same kind of repeating patterns of colors in Uganda and Tanzania that led Geoffrey Milne in the 1930s to conceive of these soils along a hill slope as representing a catena, just like the links of a chain. And so he basically conceived of the idea that these catenas, the differences in the soils along catenas are driven by drainage differences. And it's these drainage differences in turn that lead to what he termed this differential reassortment of mass along these hill slopes. So with that sort of idea in mind, our question really in Kruger National Park was to quantify the degree of differential reassortment that you can see along a granitic catena. Along these catenas, you see differences between red and white and black soils. These differences occur over distances as small or as short as 40 meters. And so we thought if we can quantify some of these, this mass redistribution, it might help us explain these patterns of soils. We used a mass balance approach, and by that I mean we took the elemental composition of the soil and we looked at individual elemental masses, mass losses and gains relative to that of the underlying granite rock. But a lot of other people have quantified this differential reassortment along granitic catenas all around the world, and so our interests also were to compare our mass losses and gains with theirs. Our work took place in Kruger National Park, which is outlined here in the middle frame. It lies between the Indian Ocean, which is tucked right down here in the figure, the Mozambique coastal plain, and the Highveld, which is a high interior plateau that cores most of central South Africa. Our average elevations are about 300 meters at the study site. And all of the data that I present today will come from 10 pedons that are arrayed along this hill slope right here. So how do you get those drainage differences that Milne invoked? Well, if you have equal precipitation falling everywhere on a landscape, you can imagine that the redistribution of infiltrated water leads to relatively drier zones upslope and relatively wetter zones downslope. If you think about soils as clay factories, which we do, you might then imagine that you might have a greater accumulation of clay downslope in this hill slope position, relatively less clay upslope. That's actually, in fact, exactly the pattern that we see. Here, I've arrayed all 62 of the horizons comprising the 10 pedons of this catena, but I've also highlighted those horizons that contain more than 25% clay. And as you'll see, those horizons cluster in the pedons furthest from the crest, those most downslope. Another thing to note from this figure is that the soils are relatively shallow. At the crest, they reach 110 centimeters. At pedon 10, the one that we sampled furthest from the crest, those depths are only up to 55 centimeters. There's an important hydrologic consequence for this non-uniform distribution of clay, and that is that as you accumulate these clays in the downslope position, any water that infiltrates and is starting to move in a subsurface flow path meets this clay plug, which is acting like an aquitard, and those subsurface flow paths are diverted to the surface, creating what are known locally as seep lines. This is what a seep line looks like from the air if you fly over the park in a small plane. You've got this characteristic vegetation line along the seep line. Above that, there's a community that we refer to as broad-leafed savanna. This is very different, as you can see, from the fine-leaf savanna that lies downslope of the seep line. This fine-leaf savanna is dominated by nitrogen-fixing legumes, primarily acacias. I'll come back to that point. So how did we get to this point where we've got such great differences in both color and clay content? Well, a useful bookkeeping tool, thank you, Charlie, for introducing this, is the CLORP model, which conceives of these differences in soil properties as being a function of these interacting state factors. And I'll just highlight the two that I think are most important for this story, and that is that we have a semi-arid climate. And we don't have a lot of water to do work in this system. If you ratio mean annual precipitation to potential evapotranspiration, you get a value of 0.3. Not a lot of water to do work in the system. But that's offset by the fact that we have very long soil residence times, approximately 200,000 years. And these are estimated on the basis of 4 beryllium 10 numbers from an adjacent watershed. All pedons are underlain by granite, gentle slopes, and then, of course, all the critters that people flock to the park. I think I calculated it's about 24,000 visitors a week. Very broadly, we could conceive of hill slopes as also being the product of these interacting factors. And I'll argue that I think the two most important factors are probably climate and time, or the duration of soil forming processes, for the differentiation of hill slopes. If you array Kruger in two-factor space, like I have here, this is climate on the x-axis, residence time on the y-axis, we might start to ask the question, I wonder if you turn the climate dial up and go to a wetter climate, how much more hill slope differentiation might you see? Well, that's a tricky question. And part of the reason is that when you get wetter, you also increase erosion. You don't have soils, really, to measure hill slope differentiation between. To go to a much, much wetter granitic catena, where folks have measured these mass losses and gains, we actually picked a site in Germany. This is Michael Sommer's work. The climate, 15 times wetter. Notice that the MAP to ET ratio is now 4, but it's 20 times younger. It was just deglaciated. So we want to look at how this balance of factors influences these mass losses and gains. I'll be showing you several figures that look like this. The y-axis is always going to be mass loss or gain in kilos of the oxide form of an element per square meter. And then the x-axis is always increasing distance from a crest. And I believe Sommer's catena was about 170 meters long, so is ours. And what I really want to highlight here is that for aluminum, iron, and manganese, our mass losses and gains are all about an order of magnitude larger than their reported mass losses and gains. So we can do another comparison, and that is, what happens if you turn back the clock? So now what I'm doing is I'm fixing the climate. We have another semi-arid granitic catena. This one's from southeastern Australia. But now I've greatly ratcheted back that clock and we're really going to be looking at how much less hill slope differentiation do we see when we go to Australia. Well, we see about an order of magnitude less. Again, the Australian data on the left panel, this catena is a little bit shorter. It's about 40 meters long. And then our data right here. But again, the losses and even the small gains, about an order of magnitude smaller than the ones that we're reporting. If you array all of these together, I think the important point here is that Milne talked about differential reassortment. And what we're seeing here is exactly what he was talking about. In every case, upslope, close to the crest, losses of aluminum and iron. Whether it's Germany, wet and young, Australia, dry and young, or South Africa, Arcatina, we've got losses upslope. And in every case, gains downslope in the most distal pedons from the crest in every case. Well, what are some of the other factors of hill slope differentiation that might be important? I don't know how many of you caught Sue Ellen's talk earlier this morning, but she was talking about strain levels in the basalts of Kruger National Park. She showed very, very negative strain values. We think that the lithology is actually important. The granites here in Kruger weather to a skeletal quartz-rich matrix. It doesn't really collapse. This is ideal for moving both water and weathering products downslope. When you go to basalts, the greater weatherability means that those soils collapse, clogging the chromatography strip. And one more factor of hill slope differentiation, and that's biota. But I'm not talking about the big five that the tourists are flocking to the park. We really think termites are playing an important role in this system. They're really doing two things, we think. The first is, by building mounds, they're basically pumping weatherable minerals up into the surface where they can be weathered, which can then lead to both chemical weathering and the transfer of weathering products. But this mixing, which is illustrated very nicely right here, also greatly increases infiltration. And I'll come back to that point in a second. So if I think that bioturbation is important in this system for hill slope differentiation, we could run into trouble, right? Because if we had bioturbation here and here, we would actually expect very little hill slope differentiation. We would expect no differences in those pedons, but instead we see tremendous differences. The answer is this effect of bioturbation is spatially non-uniform. If you go in the literature and ask, what are termite biomasses like upslope of seep lines versus below, these pie charts sort of tell the story. Biomass of termites, 5 times greater upslope than downslope below the seep line. If you then ask the question, Tony, where do you find the epigeal termites, the mound-building termites? Those are almost exclusively found above the seep line. And finally, our own observations along our catena, where do you see the tree throw, where elephants, these juvenile bulls, have been knocking over trees? All of those observations come from above the seep line. So what's really happening here in our model is that bioturbation is not only increasing the supply of weatherable minerals, but because of this, because of this tremendous mixing right here, they're maximizing infiltration so that these subsurface lateral flow paths are deeper. That reduces evaporative losses, maximizing both weathering and the transfers. Remember I said that there's not a lot of water to do work in this system. Bioturbation is making sure that for every drop of water that lands here, work is being maximized per drop. So just to summarize, there are these intermediate factors. We've got the epigeal termites, climate, very long soil residence time. In our thinking, you know, if you have these long soil residence times, plus these other intermediate conditions, they're really just perfect for maximizing hill slope differentiation. But who cares? So you've got a differentiated hill slope. And I'll give you 3 examples of why I think that these transfers of mass, or as John put it, one soil's loss is another soil's gain, why that matters. The first is phosphorus. It turns out that the soils near the crest have less phosphorus in them than was present in the granite to begin with, right? Because these are indexed to underlying rock. The soils downslope of the seep line actually have more phosphorus than they had to begin with in the granite. Now, this is important if you think about those acacias. This is where we find the acacias, downslope. Sorry, trying to find the mouse. Guess what? Acacias have a higher phosphorus demand. Okay, the second example of why mass transfers matter involves these salts. Doesn't matter now where you look. In general, we're seeing losses of all of these salts irrespective of distance from the crest in general. And that's because these salts are trying to make it out to the Indian Ocean. But again, there's not a lot of water to do work in this system. They hang up in the toe slopes, creating saline sodic zones. Very important for the distribution of things like elephants and lions, etc., because of their salt content. The last example goes back to the seep line that I mentioned. What I neglected to mention at these seep lines is that when you pop that water out onto the surface, you're going to generate overland flow, which is going to initiate incision, which means that now we've set in motion an erosional buzzsaw that's slowly propagating its way headward toward the crest. And it turns out that if you read the literature of Kruger, there are many examples where these hill slopes, some are missing toe slopes and some are not. Well, this is all a function of these mass transfers downslope. And in fact, that's where our catena ended. I neglected to point this out before, but as you walk downhill to 170 meters from the crest, we actually run out of soil. We are at a channel head, and this is slowly propagating its way upward. So it appears to us, as we survey the literature, that we actually have maximal differential reassortment of mass. We attribute that to these very long soil residence times, plus these intermediate factors, epigeal termites only near the crest, this intermediate climate, not too wet, not too dry, just the right lithology, not too soft like basalts, but not too tough like rhyolite, which also occurs in the park. And finally, 3 consequences of this catenary redistribution of mass. Phosphorus is important for driving the kinds of vegetation communities you see, salts, and then again, ushering in this new geomorphological chapter in the park in terms of the evolution of these landscapes. Our funding is from the Mellon Foundation. We've received an awful lot of in-kind support from the park, for which I'm grateful. And finally, no project like this gets presented like this without an awful lot of laboratory help. So thank you.